The use of DNA evidence in the courtroom had its big coming out party back in 1994 with the infamous bloody glove and the O.J. Simpson trial. Today, it's commonplace. Just last week, we learned that children seized from a Texas ranch run by a polygamous sect will get DNA paternity tests to see if sexual abuse went on there. It's a reality of today's courts. Genes themselves are regularly called upon to testify. And there's more to come. Some claim that new DNA tests can even predict the chances that a convict, if released, will do wrong again. Washington Post reporter Rick Weiss has been writing about genes in the courts, and he joins us now. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Faith.
Welcome back.
Thanks a lot. My genes told me I could be on the air again soon. It's true.
You have a talent for it. So let's talk about these new DNA tests. Some people are claiming they can predict the future dangerousness of convicted criminals, which sounds crazy. What are these tests?
Well, these are a family of tests that go well beyond the kind of uses that you were just talking about. I mean, DNA has been in the courts for two decades now, basically for purposes of identification, to see if some blood matches somebody else's blood or to test for paternity, as you said. Now we're talking about a variety of DNA tests that tries to get at sort of behavioral predilections of people or psychological states of people. DNA information that has to do with much more complex parts of ourselves, and that in some ways can be at least statistically predictive of what you might do someday.
All right. Let's say I'm going to do something someday. I'm going to shoplift candy from 7-Eleven, and I spend the night in jail, and before they release me, they run one of these tests, and they say, we can't let this girl go. She's prone to impulsive behavior. She can't keep her hands off the Charleston chews. It's literally in her genes.
Exactly. So, for example, one of the tests that people are looking a lot at here is something called MAOA, that is, as opposed to MAOB, such as life when you work in a genetics lab. But this is a gene which, when you inherit it in a certain form or variety, does seem to make people more prone to getting into fights, to violent behavior, to acting out on their impulses and not having the same kind of self-control superego to keep them from getting into trouble. It was discovered first in a family in the Netherlands some years ago. This is, you know, a family where every generation, they were all getting into all kinds of trouble with the law. They were always getting into fist fights with each other.
Beating each other with clogs.
Right, exactly. The question is, if you can present evidence here, if a lawyer can present evidence to a judge that says, look, here's a guy who's got this gene. He's in trouble now. We suspect he's going to get into trouble again. What does a jury or a judge do with that information? It's kind of an interesting question because you could imagine it going either way. On the one hand, you might cut the guy some slack because, hey, maybe it wasn't really his fault.
Right.
On the other hand, you might say, forget it, lock him up because he's definitely going to be a recidivist.
Right. So how are judges or ethicists coming down on this? Because, well, let's take me and my Charleston chews. If I say it's in my genes, you can't throw me back in jail because of that, then I could say that's discrimination. It's eugenics, right?
Well, right. And there is a whole, of course, awful history of the way genes have been used in sync with the law to discriminate against people. The eugenics movement of the early 20th century is notorious that way. And so we certainly don't want to, I think, see society going back in that direction. And so far, judges have been wary about letting this kind of information into the courts, although they have great discretion. The way these things work right now in the courts, they are pretty. It's pretty much up to the judge to decide what to admit. And there has been some evidence admitted at this point that shows generically familial, seemingly genetic predispositions to crimes, and it has cut both ways so far. There's at least one case where someone has gotten off of a murder charge.
Was that the South Carolina man, Rick?
Exactly. This is someone who shot a shopkeeper in the head, but the court agreed with his attorney, who argued that this was all an outgrowth of this genetically rooted depression that he had and basically said his genes made him do it. But this is by no means common yet in the courts, and there are plenty of cases that have gone the other way, and there's one I looked into that happened in Tennessee where a defendant, again, in a murder case, claimed that you couldn't convict him of first-degree murder because the inherited genetically based mental illness that he had made him incapable of forming a premeditative thought that I want to kill this person. He couldn't do it. The court didn't buy that. And there have been several people who have made arguments like that who are not here to talk on the radio show today because they have been put to death by the state. So this is not a winning argument yet, but it's one that's coming up more and more in the courts as more and more genetic discoveries linking genes to certain behaviors are being made.
And DNA is testifying in the court in more and more new ways. Apart from this future dangerousness debate, you write about how it often shows up in medical malpractice cases. Will you explain that?
Right. You know, this is an area that doctors, of course, have been very frustrated about. If there's anything wrong with a kid when the kid is born, it's quickly blamed on the doctor or the hospital as a birth injury from their negligence. And doctors are now fighting back with mixed effects, I would say, some good, some bad, by getting courts to compel genetic tests on these newborns. The idea being, hey, it's not my fault. I think this kid has a genetic disease. Now, that can be a very clarifying thing and really help get doctors rightly off the hook when this has nothing to do with anything they've done. At the same time, it's very intimidating for a parent to suddenly be told, you need to get a test on your kid and find out exactly what your kid has. And if the kid has a disease like Fragile X syndrome, the most common form of mental retardation today, you're subject to all kinds of concerns about health insurance discrimination and other employment discrimination because of health insurance needs. And in more than one case now, parents have fled the jurisdiction rather than submit to this kind of a test and find out the answer, which means in the end the doctor wins whether or not it was his or her fault.
Rick, we only have a couple of minutes left, and I want to get to these personal DNA tests. But before we do that, is there an ethical consensus being drawn around what kind of DNA evidence is going to be okay to use in court?
It's a huge debate right now, and it's getting bigger, as I say, because more and more tests are becoming available. But I'll mention quickly a couple of considerations that come into play here among lawyers and ethicists. One is whether the Fourth Amendment constitutional protection against unreasonable search and seizure might apply here. If they're taking blood or a cheek swab from you, that's going to give all this information. In the past, it's been no big deal. It doesn't hurt. It's not a big invasion. But the amount of information at stake now is much greater. And so perhaps this is an invasion. And even more interesting to me, the Fifth Amendment against testifying against yourself. At what point, you know, does blood or DNA provide enough information about you and maybe about what you're even going to do tomorrow that this constitutes literally testimony, and where you should not be forced to give up a supply of that DNA because it's going to basically help you indict yourself?
Well, it's not just the courts that have fallen hard for DNA. It's consumers. Tell me about these personal DNA testing kits. Are they really useful? They smack of good old-fashioned, you know, home shopping network charlatanism.
It's a mix. You know, there are several companies out there that are starting to sprout like mushrooms that are offering this direct-to-consumer, that is, your doctor is not involved, DNA tests to help you figure out what kind of diseases you might be prone to. That's on the more medical side. But also to figure out things about your personality, perhaps to help you meet through the company's own social networking sites other people who have the same kind of DNA as you. Because, frankly, those might be the kind of people you'd like to schmooze with more if they share the MAO variant that you have, for example. So there's a lot of different motivations that get people to spend anywhere from $1,000 to $3,000 to get these tests done on themselves. It is a pretty much wholly unregulated field at this point. The FDA looks the other way. The Federal Trade Commission has not really stepped in. There are some real issues about whether this is the kind of thing you ought to be doing as a form of entertainment. But it is a quickly growing industry.
Rick, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Rick Weiss writes about science for The Washington Post. For more about him, please visit our website, morefairgame.org.